for coming out early today and hear a little bit about conversion technologies. You know, I'm delighted to hear that the Tri-Societies is looking more at systems for feedstock production. We in USDA envision that that will be an important area. We have an MOU at ARS with the U.S. Forest Service's Forest Products Lab in Madison to try and develop feedstock flexible biorefineries. We anticipate that there's going to be a major need for these sorts of systems throughout the country. Okay, so I'm going to just jump in and try and provide a bit of a tutorial on various feedstock production or feedstock conversion technologies for biofuel production. The current one today, the big one in the world, in the United States in particular, of course, is the conversion of starches and sugars to ethanol. And, of course, it's a tried and true, age-old process of beer making. First, if you start with the starch, of course, it's got to be liquefied or saccharified with amylases into a sugar solution for sugar canes and sugar beets. Those can be fermented directly into ethanol with, of course, the old standby yeasts. And these are, of course, biological processes. The other existing one is for biodiesel production. Starting, you can see here, from soybeans, but there can come from any kind of liquids. There are processes in place now to produce biodiesel from waste restaurant oils and other vegetable and animal-derived oils. This is a transesterification process. It's a chemical process as opposed to a biological process. Now, the new actor in this arena, of course, is algae. And there's, of course, a lot of promise here and a lot of hope that algae can potentially increase yields per acre by 100 times, people are estimating. There are a lot of problems, though, or a lot of issues to overcome in the production of algae and its conversion into biodiesels or other hydrocarbon type of fuels, not the least of which is that there has to be, these systems have to be closely controlled. There has to be a switch in the environment of these algae to make them produce high volumes of oils. Then there are special strains, and of course, if you've got open ponds, you're liable for being taken over by native species of algae. You could contaminate other natural waterways with the species of algae if they're genetically engineered. Lots of issues that have to be addressed before this moves forward. The other piece of the lipid equation is that today it's the only type of feedstock that can be converted into hydrocarbon fuels, and in particular jet fuels. There are processes today that have been used to produce jet fuels and test the biojet fuel. There's an awful lot of interest on the part of the U.S. military in these technologies, as well as the commercial aviation industry, which realizes that its future really depends on some kind of liquid fuel. That you can't run an airplane on electricity. You can't run an airplane on hydrogen. It's got to be liquid hydrocarbons. And so there's a lot of interest. And, of course, once you can produce jet fuel, you can produce diesel and gasoline as well from these feedstocks. So we anticipate that there will always be, at least in the near term, a place for these vegetable oils in the feedstock biofuel supply chain. Now, of course, there's also a lot of interest in lignocellulosics, biomass. And here, the traditional conversion processes have involved, again, some kind of saccharification or dissolution of the cell wall material and subsequent fermentation, again, to ethanol. I forgot to mention that butanol is another fermentation product. There are companies right now, Butamax is one of them, a joint venture between DuPont and BP, that is commercializing a butanol biofuel, and probably mostly for the chemical markets to begin with, but they have a lot of interest, of course, in transportation fuels, butanol as a transportation fuel. So this is lignocellulosic feedstocks converted biochemically again to these alcohols. Now, the lignin, another byproduct of the dissolution or fragmentation of lignocellulosics, right now the idea is that would be used mostly for heat and power generation, which could then be helped to power the process itself or provide excess power as another byproduct or co-product of a biorefinery. Now, there are other processes, too, that are being examined for the conversion of lignocellulosics into fuels. And they're thermochemically based. One is gasification. You take the material, you burn it under low oxygen conditions to produce a syngas, mostly of carbon monoxide and hydrogen, which then can either be burned again for heat and power, or it can be converted via a Fischer-Tropsch process into, again, hydrocarbons or alcohols. and the efficiencies of the thermochemical processes are actually higher. The BTU recoveries from the biomass are higher. There are a lot of advantages with respect to plant breeding if you're going to be using this kind of biorefinery, because you just breed for maximizing yield. You're not interested in trying to develop varieties that are better able to be attacked by enzymes, have low lignin, et cetera, you just breed for maximum yield. There are, however, downsides to this. These kinds of systems, typically, if you're going to be making liquid fuels, the gas to liquids piece require very large processes where the thermal streams are integrated and heat recovery is a big part of it. So that requires an awful big investment of not only capital, but also in production resources as well to service these kinds of systems. Methanol is another potential product of this thermochemical process, which then can be transformed into fuels itself, or something can be used as a fuel by itself. Another thermochemical route is pyrolysis. It's the cooking of the biomass in the absence of oxygen to produce an oily-like substance that has a fairly high level of water in it as well. The products of this are that bio-oil and also there are gases that are produced. There's also a biochar that some feel might have not only some value as a potential offset coal, but could be used potentially as a soil amendment to increase soil productivity. But there's a lot of research that needs to be done. When it has been tried, sometimes it worked, sometimes it doesn't. And we have to figure out what is going to make it do one or the other. And actually, ARS has a nationwide team to help explore that. But the pyrolysis oil can then be upgraded, refined into hydrocarbon fuels in a typical hydrotreating step to take out the remaining oxygen, and then it can be fed to an oil refinery as an oil. The problem with the bio-oil, however, is that because of the high water content and the high acid number from, again, you've got so much oxygen in there, a lot of carboxylic acid groups. It's very corrosive, it's unstable. So a lot of research is being done right now to try and operate the pyrolysis systems in a way that would minimize the production of these organic acids and do something about the water. The lignin can also be feedstocks for either of these thermochemical approaches. Again, if it was a byproduct from a biochemical-based process. There's another process, too, that is being investigated. This has come out of Professor Dumasek's lab at the University of Wisconsin and being pursued by a number of researchers and companies, notably Virent, again, in Madison. It's called aqueous reforming, where sugar or carbohydrate portion of the lignocellulosic is actually dehydrated to some extent to form these cyclic compounds, furans, which then are upgraded in an aqueous catalytic conversion into hydrocarbons. And again, this would provide a route to get to drop-in replacements for our existing gasoline and diesel fuel structure, infrastructure. There are also other approaches being investigated and pursued right now by other companies and universities, most notably, again, Amyris, LS8, Codexis. This is to take the fermented sugar or the sugars, the monosaccharides that would normally be fermented ethanol or butanol, and develop new microorganisms that can produce hydrocarbons directly. Some of the advantages here are that the hydrocarbon product would then dissociate into a separate phase and be easily recovered. Problems, of course, is that right now the yields and the fermentation rates are very low. So even though, for instance, Amyris is scaling up, they say, their system in Brazil, there's probably still a ways away from commercializing it here, particularly for lignocellulosics, which create all kinds of other problems. It's a lot easier to do these sorts of nifty and unusual, unique reactions in a more pure sugar solution than what one would get from a lignocellulosic feedstock. So what do we have here? We have kind of a mess, don't we? A lot of options. But that's one of the things that I wanted to emphasize, is that there are a lot of options. Okay, well, let's look at the cost. This is a nice comparison by George Washington University. Some of this data is a little dated. I apologize for that. But it gives you an idea of the relative, right now, attractiveness of some of these processes. You'll note that corn-based ethanol is still by far the lowest in terms of cost relative to cellulosics or biodiesel, whether the cellulosics are converted to ethanol or are converted via thermochemical approaches. And you could see from that red vertical line there that represents the current price of oil that, yeah, today some of them look very attractive. But if one is an investor who's looking at recouping money over a 20-year period, the volatility of the oil price over the last few years would argue against that as an investment. The note below there that the corn-based ethanol being competitive with gasoline at when gas is about $2.35 a gallon and corn at $2.50 a bushel. I'll note that the closing price this past Friday on the corn futures for December delivery was almost $5.80. Okay, which I wanted to make a point here about why we're looking at, or why a number of people are looking at drop-in replacements, and what about the limits for ethanol. Many of you probably heard about the renewable fuel standard that has been in place for a while. It was revised at the end of 2007. It's managed by the Environmental Protection Agency. It requires that fuels meet some life cycle greenhouse gas reduction targets, particularly cellulosic fuels or advanced biofuels. And there's also, in addition to that, there are engine certification issues about from existing OEMs, Chrysler, GM, Ford. Right now, they'll certify their engines, existing engines that are not E85 certified, up to 15%, the new ones that are produced. The older ones, of course, that's a problem. They're just E10 limited. The bigger issue, actually, is that for volumes of ethanol in gasoline above E15, the distribution infrastructure will not accept these materials because of the problems with stress cracking and corrosivity that these fuels create for the steel and storage tanks and pipelines, etc. This is a big limitation for ethanol. This is why some people are interested in butanol. You can put a lot more butanol into gasoline and not have this problem because it acts more like a hydrocarbon. So what this does is that it creates, and I'm sure you've heard of this, this blend wall in this country, which is about 12 to 15 billion gallons. The current consumption of gasoline in the U.S. is about 140 billion gallons. So this blend wall is actually a little less than 10%. It's about 9% right now. There are limits to how much ethanol can be blended irrespective of what EPA certifies because of some issues such as increased evaporative losses in hot summer in the southern states, and California has some different regulations, et cetera, et cetera. And on the other hand, the E85 could create some bigger volume demand, but no one wants to buy E85 these days because they get in the current engines just two-thirds of the mileage that they do from gasoline. So even though the E85 engines are available and people have been buying them, they don't buy very much ethanol because there's not enough of a price differential like there is in Brazil to motivate them to do that. So we're going to have this blend wall for quite some time for ethanol. And there's also a food versus fuel issue with corn. Granted, the spike in corn prices in 2008, much of it was due to other factors other than the ethanol demand, such as the exchange rate, dollar exchange rate, etc. But that's all part of the equation, folks. As long as you've got a growing industry here for bioenergy, there is going to be this tension. We hope to, of course, produce feedstocks on more marginal lands, but this is with us. Okay, some big differences between corn starch and fermentations and fermenting lignocellulosics. The hydrolysis is less efficient, so it is a two-phase reaction, unlike with corn and amylase, and there is end product inhibition of these enzymes. So what happens is there's a lower concentration of the sugars in the end that will be fermented, and that produces a lower concentration of ethanol that then requires a lot more energy to purify. It requires a more severe pretreatment, of course, to free the sugars and break down that cell wall. And there are microbial inhibitors generated from side reactions of these pretreatments, typically. And there are multiple sugars present in the fermentation broth. If you've got one microorganism in there that's going to be fermenting and producing the ethanol, there's a lag time. Even if it can ferment both the hexoses and the pentoses, there's a lag time between switching from the easier hexoses to the more difficult pentoses. So it's more costly. There's also this issue about, and this is part of the cost and breakdown. Nature was very ingenious in developing lignocellulosics and cell walls over hundreds of millions of years to protect plants from biological and chemical attack. And one of the things that a DOE and NREL study, along with Cornell, uncovered was, this is from computer physical chemistry modeling of these systems, is that in aqueous environments, these cellulose microfibrils actually produce a highly dense sheath of water around it because of the hydrogen bonding. It's 2.5 times more dense than bulk density of water, and creates a physical barrier to enzymatic and or chemical attack. So it's no wonder it's more difficult to break down. Another challenge is in the density difference. And why is this important? It determines how much material is going to be needed to be processed by these lignocellulosic biorefineries. So you can see here that to make 10 milliliters of ethanol, that little graduated cylinder in the middle there, you've got just a bit of corn, a lot more corn fiber, and a little more distiller's grain, which of course is part of which is corn fiber, and then a whole huge liter graduate cylinder of corn stover. Big issues in logistics. And the trade-offs between densification and et cetera is target or subject of a lot of inquiry and research across the country. Some of the cost contributions. For each process area, you'll see here that, the fermentation itself and saccharification takes up almost half of the total cost, a good third of the cost. Pretreatment, another third possibly, or at least a quarter. The biomass itself, at least a third. And this is probably conservative, actually, because some of these numbers, again, came from studies that I think were predicated on $35 per ton biomass. And there's some other costs there. I'm going to skip over some of this stuff. Again, the cost challenge here. The Department of Energy is coming close, we think, to, at least for cellulosic ethanol, declaring their systems successful, that they've reached their targets that they've wanted to in terms of enzyme cost. They say they can get it down to 25 cents per gallon. Well, that's for the nth plant. For the first plant, it's at least double that still. So I think there was a recent study that came out of Iowa State that, again, said that that cellulosic ethanol is probably not competitive with corn until corn gets up to corn-based ethanol until corn gets over $7 a bushel, which actually is not too far from. So, There are commercial demonstration projects underway that mostly the Department of Energy is financing. Thermochemical, the advantages of that, again, is mostly that you can convert not just the carbohydrate portion of the lignocellulose, but the lignin portion of the cellulose to the fuel. So you get a lot more higher yield. You know, one of the things I'd like to leave you with and then go to maybe some questions is the original biorefinery is ruminant livestock, of course, and probably a number of the folks in this room have done research in this regard. Okay, so let's take a look at that as a way of comparing. The hay harvest in 2008, about 60 million acres, average yield, 2.4 tons per acre. Okay, average price in 2008, $157 a ton. Compare this to the studies that have been based on $35 a ton. Now, granted, the price is increasing. I think last year the average price was more like 130, and before then it was 110. A lot of this, again, folks, is driven by the exchange rate. Some of this material, especially alfalfa, a lot of it's being exported now. So as the dollar weakens, it's all connected. One of the barriers is going to be water, because you can double the yield of these perennials, almost double it, when you go to irrigated systems. So we see that as a big issue going forward. Well, again, I'd like to thank you all and be happy to take some time to answer questions. Yes, sir. Right. Pyrolysis, you've got the gas that can, people envision would provide some internal energy for the process itself, and they also have this biochar, which could be a solid form of fuel, like a coal-like substance, but a bit less dense, or people are looking at it as a soil amendment, like terra preta that they've seen in certain portions of Latin America. For gasification, there is an ash that, again, may be utilizable as a soil amendment to recycle some nutrients to the soil. Actually, ARS, we know we've done some work on looking at fly ash, coal ash, as a soil amendment, so it would be something similar in that regard. But one of the problems with biological approaches in general is that there are not the kinds of co-products like you've got from starch or soybean-based fuels. You've got the soy meal as a livestock feed. You've got the distiller's grains, which is high in protein, low in carbohydrate and energy, granted, but that can still is a valuable co-product. So that's one of the barriers that we see that needs to be overcome, or some other revenue streams for these biorefineries. Other questions? Okay. Yes? Well, that's why I had that last slide, this last slide that has the price of hay right now is almost, in 2008 was $157 a ton. I don't know what the current price is. I don't buy hay myself. These are figures from NAS, National Ag Statistics Service, so we kind of use that as an official number, but I would suspect that it's still pretty high. I have some friends who own horses, and they complain. Steve. No, it's not. And that's why I think that a lot of the demonstration projects right now that are looking promising are ones that are looking at the cobs and the stover and other ag crop residues as feedstocks. And the industry in general is seeing that there are a lot more opportunities in converting waste right now, materials, waste, quote-unquote, even though, again, for crop residues, there are other values for these materials, but whey from dairy processing, food processing wastes, they look very attractive feedstocks right now in the near term for fuel production, particularly if the tax credit, volumetric tax credit for ethanol goes away, and you know, they really have to compete on a level basis. You're going to have to go for these lower value feedstocks for sure. One more?
We have to stop.
Okay. You can catch me after the meeting, sure. Thank you.